You're listening to Start Writing, where we explore the great minds behind the greatest stories. Hosted by Joseph Bendosky, author of the Skyfall series, and Jay Washburn, author of the Star Child space opera. I'm a StarCraft fan, and I recently read a spin-off novel called Heaven's Devils, and I honestly had somewhat low expectations, so I was pleasantly surprised and even impressed. William C. Dietz delivered vivid characters, great descriptions, and a thoughtful, smart story. It was also fun to go on an adventure with some of my favorite characters, including Jim Raynor and Tychus Finley, as they're getting their start as Space Marines. So I reached out to Mr. Dietz, and we discussed a couple of interesting insights for aspiring authors. The first centers around writing in other IPs. IP stands for intellectual property, and in this context, that means a world and its characters. Bill Dietz has written in a lot of famous IPs that are not his original creations, including Star Wars, Halo, StarCraft, Hitman, and Mass Effect. He tells how he got started doing this and about the highs and lows that come with this sort of work for hire. The second main insight is this. He started in the traditional publishing world, and now he has a strong presence in indie publishing too. And I asked him which of these two he preferred, and his answer surprised me. This was such a fun interview. I am so impressed with his humility. I was also intrigued by his final admonition to all of us listeners. Before we start, I wanted to make a personal comment. When I was a kid, I was so obsessed with the Jedi Knight video games that I even checked out the audio dramatizations of that story from our local library, and I listened to them with my older brother, and he's who I wrote about in Stealing Indiana Jones. But it has been so long since then that I actually forgot. Well, it turns out that these novelizations were written by William C. Dietz. So you'll hear me say something in this episode that makes it sound like I was unfamiliar, but after recording this episode, I looked them up, I re-listened, and all the memories came flooding back. It was a ton of fun to relive that part of my childhood, and I also checked out the cool artwork of the book versions that he talks about in this episode, and those are impressive as well. Okay, I've said enough. Here's our Start Writing interview with William C. Dietz on how to write in someone else's world.
Tell me how your day has been.
Well, it's been good. You know, I usually start my day about 4 o'clock in the morning. I get up, You know, do the exercises, have some breakfast, start writing about 7, You know, write for at least 3 hours. A goal is like 3 pages a day.
Oh, really? What, you mentioned exercises. What do you do in the morning for exercise?
I do floor exercises with weights for about 20 minutes. And then I do 20 minutes on the treadmill, you know, like about a 5 incline, 2.8 speed, which is, cool. You know, okay for an old geezer. And and that works pretty well for me.
How did you make health habits a part of your lifestyle?
Well,
was that family culture?
No, that was, I came to being sort of in shape later in life. You know, I always had, you know, a little bit of a weight problem. You know, I wasn't like hugely obese or anything, but I just always was carrying around 10, 15 extra pounds. And when I retired from the corporate world and began to write full time, I decided to try and get it together and, started eating differently and added exercise, regular exercise to my regimen. And so it has worked pretty well. I'm down probably 20 pounds from where I was when I retired. So that's good.
Dang. That's super cool.
How about you? What do you do for exercise?
So I've been doing a lot of treadmill stuff. I don't know if you've heard about zone 2 training, but
no.
You try to get your heart rate at a certain level and keep it there. So like for me, that's a pretty fast uphill walk, but I've been doing a lot of that.
Well, good for you.
So,
well, you look like a guy who's been in shape all along.
Well, trying to, it's been a little up and down for me too, but yeah, trying to make it a good habit.
Yeah. So. Good.
Hey, so I see in the background, you have three posters and those are book covers of yours, right?
Yeah, it's a trilogy. It's a prequel trilogy for my Legion of the Damned series, written after the first, you know, 8 or 9 books, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And so those were copies of the book cover, which the artist kindly just sent me. And I really appreciated it and framed them. And
dang, that's cool.
They're the same woman all looking in different directions, each with a big gun.
That's super cool. No, so I saw that artwork online on your audiobooks, and it's just, man, that's some great artwork.
Well, good. I'm glad you like them. I've been fortunate to have audiobooks all along, and I think very few, if any, of my books are not on audio.
Dang.
So that's been great.
Yeah, that's sweet. Okay, well, I have some questions about writing and about writing in other people's IP, but first I kind of just want to do some get-to-know-you questions. And this is kind of a weird question, but tell me a story about your name. And that could be like a nickname or the etymology of your last name.
I'll tell you a story about my name. So when I was born, I was named William Rory Dietz, R-O-R-Y. And my father at that time was in the Navy. It was World War II. And but he'd been a cinematographer, director of photography for Paramount Studios before the war. And he was a cameraman, a combat cameraman during the war, and eventually led a crew of other cameramen and so on in the Navy. And he was very conscious, you know, which is weird for 1945, he was very conscious of names and the value or the impact of names from sort of a showbiz perspective, because he knew all these actors and actresses and so on. So they chose Rory, trying to come up with something a little different. And the tradition in the family was, it was, if you're male, it was always William first. So my grandfather's William Charles, my father's William Holt, and I was William Rory. But the problem was that everybody kept calling me Roy, you know. Oh, Roy is such a cute baby. We hope they said that. and that just really PO'd my parents. So they went to court and did what they had to do to change my name to Corey, C-O-R-E-Y, which was a weird name in 1945, but it's now, as you know, pretty common and like no big deal. So there's your story.
Dang, that's great. Man, and so if I understand right, you followed your dad's footsteps into both military and filmmaking. Is that right?
You've really done your research. I appreciate that. Yeah. I did not initially follow my father into filmmaking and communications generally, because I was a layabout as a young man. I mean, I was, I think, pretty totally worthless. You know, I mean, I wasn't a good student. I was pretty lazy and not very productive at all. And so much so that when I finished high school, I really didn't have anything to do. There were no jobs at the time and I didn't want to live off my mother. And so I joined the Navy so I could eat. And, I was in boot camp when the Vietnam War started. And I remember all of us in boot camp, the guys with me down in San Diego, were all going, what? We didn't plan on this. They're going to have a war. We were just joining the Navy, you know, to like have a job or whatever. So that was came as a shock.
Well, and, so did you get shipped over there to Vietnam?
I did not. Later on, I went to hospital corps school, became a medic, a Navy medic, and the Marine Corps uses Navy medics rather than have their own medical corps because they're part of the Navy.
Yeah.
And eventually, I had to go through the training to go to Vietnam. And at the end of the training, there was like 20 of us waiting to see what our orders were going to be. And we assumed, all of us, that we're going to Vietnam. And 18 sets of orders came in to go to Vietnam, and 2 sets of orders came in to go to Hawaii. And guess who got one of those? I was very lucky. Very
that's
lucky
crazy.
Indeed. Yeah.
Huh. Dang. Well, that's cool.
But, oh, to finish answering your question, as I got out of the Navy, I was planning to go to college, and I thought I wanted to go into journalism. And I was having a drink with a Navy buddy of mine who'd gotten out before I did in a bar in San Francisco. And we were sitting there at the bar, and he asked me what I was going to do. And I said, I think I'll get a degree in journalism because I want to write. Mm-hmm. And you can't make any money just writing. You need some kind of way to get a paycheck coming in. So I'll become a journalist. And this gentleman sitting next to me, he's wearing a business suit and a tie and everything, and having, I think it was a Manhattan. And he says, excuse me, son, could I just interject something? I thought, sure, go ahead, interject something. And he said, well, I'm an editor for a Bay Area newspaper, and I'd like to just suggest to you that you do not get a degree in journalism, but you get a degree in communications instead. And I remember thinking, what is a degree in communications? I mean, I literally had no idea. It was only after I got home and started to look into it that I found out that, you know, that it could be journalism, but it could also be radio, TV. And I pounced on that. And that, to answer your question, is how I sort of unknowingly wound up doing what my dad did and then went, oh, wow, this is weird, you know, and became a television director for a local television station later on after graduating from college and so on.
Yeah, man, so that reminded me. So your dad, the stuff he was filming in the war, was he trying to capture the war itself, or was he creating like, I don't know what you call it, like encouragement videos or what kind of stuff?
Yeah, both, absolutely. Again, very insightful of you. He, a lot of his work was in Washington, D.C. and other locations, filming, you know, ships being launched or, you know, admirals giving speeches or, you know, all of those kind of PR kind of things. But he did go to the Pacific. He was on the USS Denver. I believe it was the Denver, which is a heavy cruiser. And saw combat kamikaze planes coming in, and he filmed them, you know, coming in. And I often, having seen some montages of Navy battle footage from the Pacific, I've always wondered if his stuff was buried in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But, of course, I have no way to know since he passed away when I was 3. I never got to ask him all the questions you would ask. So all my knowledge is secondhand through my mother. Yeah.
Hmm. Man, that is so interesting. So has his career filming and capturing the war, has that ever made it into one of your novels, like something similar?
No, it hasn't. I mean, I think it's influenced me in various ways, but not directly. No.
Cool. Well, so you've had an illustrious career and you have a ton of books, 50 plus. Is there a natural way to break your career down into segments? And like, I've worked on this and then this and then that.
Just 1 second. I'm going to adjust the audio again. You know, I've never thought about it that way. That's an interesting question. You know, I in a way it hasn't changed at all, and in a way it has changed a lot. I guess I would say, you know, I started out writing space opera. My first book was called War World. They later changed the title to Galactic Bounty. And it was about a bounty hunter named Sam McCade. And I wrote that book, and I think it was like 84, and I was 40 years old. I had I'd always said I was going to write a book, and I said I'll write it by the time I'm 40. And I turned 39, and I hadn't put a single word down. I'd been busy, you know, as a TV director, producer. I'd, you know, worked at Rockwell in marketing communications, and I was working for the television, I was working for the local telephone company as a TV director at that time. And I hadn't done anything. So I said, okay, well, I know that it's impossible. I know it won't sell. I know all that, but I promised myself I'd do it. So at 39, I sat down and I wrote the kind of book I like to read, which was adventure, space opera, you know, cowboys in space, kind of, in a way. And certainly the fact that my hero was a bounty hunter, that was very Western. When you think about it, it's just translated into the far future. And what would that be like with aliens and all of that? And so I sent that in unsolicited to Berkeley Publishing. Ace was their science fiction line. And didn't hear anything back, which I knew to be the case, that you weren't likely to hear anything back. But I didn't even get a rejection slip, and I wanted the rejection slip. You know, I wanted some acknowledgement that at least it had gotten there and somebody looked at it. So I phoned in, just cold called there, and lucked out, and wound up speaking to an editorial assistant named Sue Stone. I told her my story. Listen, I said, I know you're just going to reject this, but, you know, could you just acknowledge that it came in and that it's terrible, and then I'll just move on, you know? And she said, well, I should have seen it. You know, I haven't seen it, and I'll look for it. And so that was the end of the conversation. And I thought, yeah, sure, she's not going to look for it, you know? And I went back to doing my work. And like, I'd say 4 weeks later, I was directing a piece in the studio, and the phone rang, and somebody said, hey, Bill, it's a call from you. It's from somebody in New York. And I get on the phone, and it's Sue. And she says, you know what? I found it. And she said, not only that, but we'd like to buy it.
Whoa. Your first shot.
Yeah, my first try. And so, you know, once you, the way the business works, and I'm sure you know this, Jay, you know, once you sell a book, you can probably follow up and sell another one. And so long as you stay inside the lanes of that genre and so on, you know, had I suddenly tried to write a romance novel, that would have probably been rejected, but I was able to just keep writing for them and continue to write for them for 30 years. So that was a stage. And now I'm getting to the more fulsome answer to your question. I guess that when that relationship ended and I began to self-publish, that would be the second stage. And, you know, the first 30 years of it, working for a big five publisher was, you know, really great. I mean, I'm so grateful and thankful for having had it. But then this period of time since then where I haven't been working with them has been great too, but just in a different way. The freedom that I have to do what I want, when I want, how I want, how much I want, all of those things has been great.
Dang, that's cool. Tell me about your transition. Like, what year was that? What was your last book that was traditional and your first book that was indie?
Oh boy. You know, I haven't memorized those dates. And it was a gradual thing. I would, I hate to put it forward, but I would say that by, you know, by 2015 or something like that, you know, I was trailing off. I think the last series I did for them was a trilogy called, the Mutant Trilogy. And, you know, it was an attempt to try and break into a slightly parallel place from where I was, you know, get a little bit out of the military science fiction area and into something else. And it didn't do incredibly well. And the people at Berkeley were not totally impressed. And so, you know, that sort of languished. It did not, you know, do well financially. And that encouraged me to kind of take a shot and started looking, doing stuff on my own. And that worked pretty well. So I'm still doing that.
And you started with your World War III series. Was that the beginning of your indie career?
Yeah, that was, I had actually experimented with a couple of books years before that, early in the self-publishing, you know, cycle, if you will, with Amazon, two books. They had not done any kind of business that was, you know, it didn't seem to me like it was worth the trouble. And at that time, I still had the regular career going. So I just kind of broke it off and years went by. Mm-hmm. And then when I made the transition, I tried to come up with what I hoped would be a winning formula. And the idea that I had was just that I wanted to continue to write military, which is primarily what I do, but to do, you know, near future alternative fiction. So it's just like not way off in the future like the science fiction novels I've written, but more like a year from now, what could be a year from now. Mm. So the series is about a worldwide war that takes place just over the event horizon. And my idea from the beginning was that it would be a series, but that each book in the series would be different from the other books in that it would be same setting, same situation, mm-hmm. but a different protagonist, different secondary mm-hmm. characters, different location, different, you know, service. So it might be Navy one time, Air Force the next, Army the next,
wow.
and so on. It might be, you know, in Europe the first time, and, you know, in Africa the next, and so on. And the problem with being an author writing anything for yourself is that you have no, you know, marketing research to guide you. All you have is the numbers. Does it sell? And according to those numbers, it's working, and a lot of people like it, and I've done very well financially. But I wish I knew more about the audience and who's buying and why and what they're thinking. And you know, you can look at the stars. There, I think I can say this without exception. They're all, you know, like 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
But you don't know exactly why, you know, but and you just wonder what are the exact finite little things that people care about. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, so let me make a comment and a question. One of your back covers I noticed said it has the phrase like, and Russia uses that as an excuse to invade Ukraine. Like you predicted that. I just thought that was a super cool little tidbit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you raise a larger question for those who write in the space that I write. And, you know, a good way to think about it, Jay, is that it's, you know, if you've got military as a big wide category, and then you've got near future alternative military, that's like a niche within a niche within a niche or something. Mm. And I'm not the only one that writes in that category. And, you know, and in that niche. And where I'm headed here is that I know that some of my competitors, you know, made some other choices about how all the real war was going to go, you know, and I know at least one of them made Ukraine into a bad guy and Poland into bad guys. Yeah. And, they were, you know, in the Third World War, they were a problem and so on. I fortunately did not go in that direction.
That's so great.
So, and I went off my, I went off a feeling of sympathy that I had towards Ukraine, even prior to this, you know, the invasion by Russia, and a sense that was an important point in Europe and a potential flashpoint. And so I'd say it was partly good conceptual thinking and partly, of course, luck, like so many things, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And so you said you switch protagonists every novel. And to me, as you know, I'm an author, that seems challenging sometimes to create new backstories. But I can see there are advantages to it, too, where you get to start new arcs, you know, and that can be good. Anyway, any thoughts on switching protagonists every time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in part, it was a defensive move because I'd written, of course, long series, you know, like, say, Legion of the Damned, you know, 8-9 books in the first series. And, you know, and it creates this problem of you've got main characters that you fall in love with. Maybe if you're lucky, readers fall in love with them as well. And, you know, and they need to continue to grow and they need to change and they need to, you know, have new adventures and you got to feed the monster, you know, and that's what it becomes after a while. And if you want to see what that looks like in a different context, look at Clancy's novels. You know, you start out with a guy who's basically just a security expert kind of, you know, guy working for the government and he winds up president of the United States. You know, six books down the road. And that is just, you know, I wanted to stay away from that kind of, I felt like that was just so unbelievable. And so, come on, give me a break, you know, that I just could not believe it. And so I was defensive in that sense. And, you know, it's an opportunity each time to come up with someone different, somebody engaging. Also, I can't say some outside observer would have to say, but I've always tried to have some diversity in my books, meaning what diversity generally means. I wanted to have male heroes. I wanted to have, female heroes. I wanted to have black heroes. I wanted to have gay people in my books. I wanted to have it all, you know, and that gave me an opportunity to do that.
So I recently read your StarCraft novel and I was impressed that, the cast seemed diverse but they all seem memorable. And I guess that seems impressive to me that you're doing that over and over in each book, but yeah, anyway, well done.
Well, thank you.
So let me ask you about cover art. So as an indie author, you gotta either create or hire your own art. And actually, I don't know if those ones on the walls behind you were part of your indie. They're probably not, huh?
They're not, no.
Yeah. Well, tell me about creating the artwork as an indie author. How do you do that?
Well, let me first, you know, tell you about what it's like to get, you know, covers from one of the big five.
Okay.
And I'll be brief about that and spend most of my time talking about answering your question. But I mean, first, in contrast to the big five, is that you get down and your editor says, "So, Bill, it's time to come up with a cover for your book. And do you have any ideas?" And so I say, like in the case of America Rising, that was a trilogy. I said, "Well, you know, the heroine of the book, hero, if you will, but had to be female, is a striker officer in the army. And striker vehicles, you know, are central to the whole thing. So how about book covers with striker vehicles on them?" And then she says, "Okay, well, that's interesting." And, you know, and she took it to the art department at Penguin and they, you know, chewed it over and they hired somebody. And sure enough, they came up with three covers that had strikers on the covers and they're pretty good covers.
Oh, cool.
And so that worked well. And I mean, it's amazing the amount of money the big five puts into some of these, covers. I mean, some of them, prior to the advent of Photoshop and all the computer tools, they were oil paintings and stuff sometimes. I mean, an amazing amount of money and talent. Yeah. Now, fast forward to doing it for yourself. Fortunately for me, I've always had an interest in covers and felt that I had some ideas and so on for covers. And so the issue is finding, you know, A, you got to come up with your idea, hopefully, yourself. But I suppose there are authors who aren't able to do that. And they hand off their manuscript to an artist who comes up with an idea for them. I don't know. But B, you know, if you have the concept, you have to find somebody who can execute on it. Mm-hmm. And so in many cases, there are, you know, companies that just, that's what they do. They do covers for self-published authors. And they're at their best when they're just doing, you know, faces, you know, the guy with the muscled body, you know, for a bodice ripper, and, you know, you see his chest and all that, and he's a handsome devil and beautiful, beautiful women and all of that. Then there's another section of people who will do kind of like more of what I would call an illustration, you know, it'd be like, let's say it's a naval thing and it's a ship at sea and, you know, two ships from the, 1700s are firing on each other with broadsides. You've seen those, you know, and the cannons are going off and so on. There's that kind of thing. And that's a different kind of artist usually working in a different way because they're using more tools than the people who are just doing faces are. And then, you know, recently I did two books, Crickets 1 and Crickets 2. And those are hyper real art, and that requires a specialist. And I had to track down artists in both cases. Patrick Turner did the first one, and he'd done a lot of work for Bain Books, and so I had to sort of not only contact him, find him, you know, but pay him a great deal of money and so on to get that done. But it's the look that I wanted, that kind of that pop, you know, that this look, oh my God, this looks almost real. So unfortunately he passed away, and then I had to find another artist to do the second one. So yeah.
Dang, that's tricky. Well, and then your World War III series, I love the covers and how they go together. Like they just really look like a series. I'm sure that makes it easy for someone to just grab the next one. Cause it just feels so cohesive. But.
Well, Jay, you ask questions that, you know, please me greatly because that too was part of my concept. You know, when I, in terms of designing the series is I, from my marketing background and marketing communications and just my interest and my personality or whatever, I thought what I want to do is have a series that has a very, very recognizable logo of its own. And since the first book was Red Ice, you know, I decided, well, hey, that's, I'll just go with red. Every book will be, the first word will be red, and then it'll be red something, you know. It'll be, my most recent one is Red Dog, and, you know, others are Red Thunder and Red Dragon and so on. So if you're a reader and you like my stuff, you know, you just get a glimpse of one of those and you go, oh, geez, that's a Dietz book. I haven't read that one. You know, I can tell. And then I would put an artifact in there that had something to do with the story, you know, a flying hat in the case of Red Dog, a pistol in the case of, you know, the first one, Red Ice, and so on. Then these are just symbolic, and they get away from the whole deal of having to have a face, a character face, you know, on the cover. And the continuity is obvious. And when you look at them on Kindle, when you look at them online on Amazon, I mean, they look great, and they just, you know, they just line up and roll along, and they're eye-catching, I believe, he said modestly.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So
as an indie author, you are now a publishing company. So you got to be the marketer and the publicist. Do you hire somebody to do marketing? Or I can imagine that because of your career, you can kind of just ride that fame. But what do you do as far as marketing your indie books?
Well, I'd say that you're pretty close with your last comment. I mean, I was fortunate when I went out on my own that I had a brand already. So mm-hmm. a lot of what I've done would be impossible without that. So I owe all of that to Berkeley and Ace and the Big Five. So I do kind of ride that. I don't want to say I'm famous, but I'll say I'll ride the brand. Okay. Cause it would sound uh-huh. conceited to say something else. And I know where I am and, you know, I'm somewhere, but I'm not Stephen King or anything like that. I know that. But I do a certain amount. It's a very modest amount. And that is I have built over time a list of people who have written into me or in one way or another indicated that they would like to know when I'm doing stuff. So I have a pretty good email list, you know, that when I'll send out a personal email to hundreds of people when a book drops. And, you know, I'll usually get back, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 notifications that the email failed because they've moved on from wherever they were. But the rest, you know, stick seemingly. And I think it helps you get a little bit of traction right off the top. Yeah. Secondly, I use Facebook, which it's hard to evaluate. I don't know how good it is, but I think it makes a difference. And I have, I don't know what, you know, 1,500, 2,000 followers, something like that. That's not a lot by today's, you know, measures. But if it's targeted, you know, if it's people mm-hmm. who've read me, then that's a great deal. If it's not, if it's just people who are curious, then it's not as great a deal. And I don't know which it is, frankly, but I do that. I always, you know, accept invitations like this one. I think they're valuable and I appreciate it and value what you do because folks like you are like opinion leaders that are a valuable part of, you know, the communications of letting people know what entertainment is available. But that's it. I don't pay a PR company or anything like that. No.
Cool. If there's a young author listening to our podcast and they're trying to decide, well, should I shoot for the traditional route or the indie route? Do you have any advice for them?
Well, I guess I would say that why not go both? You know, I don't see any real downside to it. You know, maybe you'll be the lucky one like me who, you know, sends it in somewhere and you luck out, you get the right editor, they look at it, you know, and you're just in the right place in the right time. Let me comment on that for a second, if I may. And I need a sip of water. Just a sec.
Yeah.
What I didn't mention to you about that first book, War World, is that later, after I sold that book to the editor that I mentioned, Sue Stone, I had occasion every now and then to go to New York on business for the company I worked for. And by the way, speaking to young writers, do not give up your day job. Don't even think about it. You know, do what you do, whatever it may be. Big, medium, humble, whatever, do it because it's really hard to make a decent living and have a family and stuff like that on what you're going to make from writing, you know, in general. There are exceptions, but but very few. Anyway, so I was on a business trip to New York and I had lunch with her. And this is not too long after publishing the book, maybe a year later or something. And I just said, well, I felt so lucky, Sue, that, you know, that you were there and you chose my book. I really appreciate that. And it was really good. And she said, well, Bill, you have to understand, you know, we thought it was okay, but you know, we were just kind of short on that kind of shit at that time. And so, you know, that went a long way towards keeping me humble. Okay. But the message, though, to a young writer, as you put forward, is that being in the right place at the right time, just luck. There's no substitute for that. But you can't luck out if you don't reach out and you don't try, you know. So why not send it to agents and send it to publishers, you know, following their rules? You know, they're very serious about those rules. If they say you got to do you send two chapters and a description, that's exactly what they mean. Don't send them eight chapters and something else. Follow the rules that they lay out. But meanwhile, there's no reason why you can't be taking a shot at trying to do something on your own. Because again, you reach out, you may succeed. But anyway, you may have a talent which is such that it catches the attention of readers and they just jump on it right online. And, you know, and as a result, you'll have that to prove your point with big five, you know, companies if you want that experience and that kind of writing. And B, you're practicing your craft, you know, write. I mean, you just have to write. Because all writers are really self-taught. I mean, you can go to college. You can, you know, I was an English minor. You can go, you know, to all kinds of seminars and stuff, which I don't attend, but never did. But some people get help there. I think more often than not, those are really a waste of time compared to just writing. You know, just do it.
Dang, well, that's some great advice. And honestly, I thought you were going to pick one of the two. And I really like that nuanced answer you gave. That's excellent. Okay, so another, I think, really unique and cool thing about your career is that you've written in other people's IP. So you've written in Star Wars, Halo, Hitman, StarCraft, and Mass Effect.
Some people, I've been accused of being a whore.
Okay, yeah. Tell me what's going on.
I do it for money, definitely, or did do it for money. I got to tell you, those were, for the most part, on average, overall, some of the best fun I've ever had. I mean, I love those experiences. And there are those kind of snooty people in the writing profession who look down on work for hire, as it's called, and regard that to be really second-rate stuff. I don't. I see it in a completely different way. I think it's like such a wonderful opportunity to, you know, get into some really interesting universe, you know, like Star Wars, for example, that you could never, ever, you know, crack, never be part of, to be part of it, to get in there. And I mean, they took me down, they brought me down to the Lucas Ranch back when the Lucas Ranch was something. You know, I got to go there with my editor, flew in from New York. We got to meet with, you know, all kinds of people in the planning of those stories and so on. Meet with the artists who were going to do it. I mean, it was big time. It was fun. It was just out and out fun. And then the freedom to sit down and they gave you this big canvas to work on, said this is what it sort of has to be around and it needs to be about this in a general way, but it's up to you to really lay in the lines there and to work with these artists and to, you know, get the whole thing done. And it was space opera and I was getting paid really good money for it too. And I mean, it was just a kick. And so that was a wonderful experience. And for the most part, all of them were good in different ways.
You mentioned Lucasfilm kind of did a little whining and dining. Did any of these other video game companies do something similar? Give us another contrasting example.
Well, Certainly not everybody did that. You know, like I know you've been reading, I think, Heaven's Devils, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the blizzard brought me down to Los Angeles, flew me in. A limo met me at the airport, you know, took me to their headquarters. And they have this campus that is just mind-boggling. I assume they still have it. But I mean, it's like a park. It's like an amusement park crossed with a, I don't know what, some kind of fancy, you know, botanical garden or something. It was really amazing. And their whole place was really like that. So certainly that was very first class. They were very good to me and very nice to me. So that comes to mind. Halo was different because I live within driving distance of the studios where Bungie's, at that time, Bungie's studios were, you know, only an hour away by car. And so there wasn't that kind of a deal, but that was also good. And that, you know, it was, that made it more accessible where I could sit down with the principals and so on. And I'll tell, I just got to tell you one thing that all of these experiences had in common. And that is that, that of course, since I started my career at 40, by the time I'm doing this IP work, I'm, you know, older than that. And then some of it continued, you know, and was taking place when I was in my 60s. So you would drop into these meetings for these kind of game companies, and you would not only be the oldest person in the room, you would be the really oldest person in the room. And I mean, all these 20-something, early 30-something guys, mainly guys, a few women, you know, would go, God, you know, you could just read the bubble over their heads. Who sent Grandpa and what's it about? You know, what? Who is this dude? Why is he here? You know, I mean, that was particularly true with, you know, with some rather than others. And and then you had to really prove yourself to, you know, to roll with those folks. And then some of them were deals where you never met anybody. It was all done, you know, through email and phone calls and and like that. So a hitman would be an example. You know, with Hitman, I got to interact with, you know, it was a foreign company, at that time a Dutch company, now owned by the Japanese. But my editor, I knew him, I met him, you know, I never got to see the principals or go to their offices or anything like that.
I'm imagining that you were not familiar with the IP. Then you got the opportunity and you had to crash course, like get yourself up to speed. And I don't know if you could do this for StarCraft. You could, I mean, I'd love to hear StarCraft, but you could do it for any of them. But like, how did you get yourself up to speed on this IP? I mean, because sometimes these are huge universes and it seems like a big challenge.
Well, you correctly identified that as one of the most difficult to come up to speed on. I will say that. And it also, you know, I mean, they not only was it a very complicated universe because, you know, it's a game, but it's also a series of books that had been written by somebody else a certain way. And those books had been written with very, very intense involvement by management at Blizzard. And so you're walking into a deal that you're standing in for somebody who had this close relationship with the owner, head dude. And so it was tough to come up to speed. And I'll be honest with you, I never felt that you know, they totally bought into my rendition of the whole deal. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it was a feeling I had. They never said you suck or something, but, you know, but I never felt sometimes, you know, with some clients, I would feel like a real simpatico and like that, but I never really felt like I got inside that organization. And I did my best, but, and the book has since then, you know, done, I think, pretty well. I haven't looked at it on Amazon in a way, but I think it's got good ratings.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's
maybe
a great
you
book.
Looked.
It's
I don't
a great
know.
Book.
But but that was a tough one to do. But I did my best. And to more fully answer your question, you know, first it involves, in this case, reading the books that preceded it. Mm-hmm. You know, because you're following along, you know, after some other stuff. And then if you can, in the, you know, play the game, and sometimes you absolutely have to play the game, you know, almost frame by frame. A good example of that would be Halo, The Flood.
Okay.
Where what I was doing, and I would just say to your viewers and followers, you know, they need to remember that there's two types of situation here. One is a novelization, which means that you're taking a game and turning it into a novel, which is what Halo the Flood was. Or there's, you know, rather than novelizing the game, you're actually writing a novel set in a universe, which would be like the Star Wars books, you know, or Hitman, for example. But where you're writing a brand new story, but it's based on a game or based on an IP. So in the case of Halo, The Flood, you know, I had to play the game like over and over and over again and take copious notes I played the game. I'd never played it before. And, you know, capture all the things, you know, record the ideas that I had, come up with, you know, my ideas that I wanted to do, because I had negotiated at the front end of that one. I had told the folks at Bungie that, you know, I hope I didn't say it in any kind of a conceited way, but I mean, just an honest way, I'm really busy with my regular stuff. And this is interesting and I'd like to do it, but only if I can bring something a little bit new to it. You know, it's a novelization. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to do just a complete rote novelization. I just am not interested. But I said, how about if you let me inject new material in the cutscenes? You know, when you're playing games and it cuts to black and then, you know, the story picks up somewhere else or whatever. That's a cutscene, you know, that right in between. And that's usually the place where one level, what's called a level, separates from another level. And each level generally has a level producer and a crew working on it because, you know, nobody could do all the art and all of that, you know, and then these level producers have to cooperate with each other to create the overall game. And of course, I didn't know any of that when I started, but I learned. And in fact, I eventually wrote a game for Sony, you know, in the Resistance series, was invited based on my work for the IP to write a game, you know, and collaboration with another writer. But anyway, I pitched the idea that in between these scenes I could inject new characters doing new things. And they were really reluctant because they said, well, we don't really want to, you know, introduce new people and stuff that we have to deal with later on after you're done and we're moving on and we're doing stuff. Now we're got these characters and, you know, what do we do with them? They said, so here's the deal. You can do what you want so long as you kill off all the characters that you create at the end of the game.
That's crazy.
And I did.
Wow.
Yeah. And that hurt, but I enjoyed the process and I'm a huge Halo fan. I mean, I've played all the Halo games that have come along since. And,
that's so great.
You know, and it's such a great character and a great universe. And you know, and it thrills me. It's some of the stuff I'm proudest of is my IP work. And, you know, I'll see stuff occasionally online or somewhere where I'll get credited by somebody who actually knows enough about it to say, and Dietz created that character in there. And that'll just be a big thrill for me. I mean, I get as much enjoyment out of that as I do getting, you know, praise for my original work. It means a lot to me. I love it. Yeah.
Dang. That's super cool. So I just found out, like yesterday, that you'd written the Star Wars Dark Forces novels. And I was a huge fan of those games when I was a kid. And anyway, I'm not familiar with your novels yet, but I need to go look them up because I'd love to dive back into that story.
Yeah, do that. They're fantastic. You know, you're obviously a guy who loves books, and these books are were made to be collector's items. It was a partnership between Lucasfilms, Dark Horse Comics, and Berkeley Publishing Ace. The three companies got together to produce these books. And from the very beginning, you know, Dark Horse's role on it was to handle the illustrations. And there's full color illustrations about every three or four pages. And I mean, it is fantastic artwork. I mean, this is like, you know, this is, you know, and the paper is this glossy, wonderful, heavy duty paper. I mean, this is just, you know, the typography is incredibly thought out, and it's just it's just beautiful. I mean, you're just, you know, and because of that, they command, their collector's items, and to get an original copy, $100, $200, $300, that kind of thing is not unusual. And so there's three volumes and three different artists, an artist for each volume. And that, as I said, was really a fantastic thing. First class work on it. Very, very proud of those books. Yeah.
Dang, that is so cool. Well, so I don't know if you want to revisit this story, but I understand that you had to kill off a character in Mass Effect, maybe reluctantly, and you got the flak, but it wasn't even your decision.
That's true. Boy, talk about blowback. I mean, I got flamed, you know. I'd never been flamed before, never had that kind of blowback. And I mean, it was like full troll time. And the interchange was available online. I mean, you could see everybody discussing, okay, let's get ready. We're going to take him down, you know, and then you just get this flood of hate and everything. It was intense, but you're right. There was a character, a girl that, you know, there was one of a number of much beloved characters in this thing. And that was, and I had orders from the people who hired me from the company. They wanted to get rid of her, they saw her as a problem in terms of, you know, just what they were trying to do in the big picture. And so that was certainly one reason, but then they also took issue with, and I don't know whether it worked backwards or not, but I mean, I think that created this, put the spotlight on it and the spotlight on me. And then, I mean, they went through page by page, annotating everything that was wrong. You know, I mean, I put in things that was, you know, like a joke about somebody eating morning cereal and stuff, because, you know, there was some of that kind of humor I felt in the preceding books, but oh my God, you know, they just tore that up. They tore everything up without exception. They hated it, and they made that very clear. And what they tried to do was to submarine the book, you know, to take it down. So they wanted it to be taken down, taken offline, pulled back, out of stores, off Amazon. Crazy. They wanted to absolutely kill it, and that was their goal. But
it's just terrible.
Funny thing, on the way to the, you know, to the trying to take it down was that first, before they were able to get their full scale thing going, it got on the New York Times best-selling list. So I have that satisfaction of knowing that before they started, it did pretty well. And then they got going, and of course then it came off the list shortly thereafter. So that was bad, and you know, it shows you the dangers that are inherent in the whole thing too. You're taking some risk. Oh, I should mention too that the author who preceded me had written those books, done a great job, and was beloved of his audience, you know. And they were just offended that anybody, they thought no one could replace him or should replace him, which is great. I mean, you know, nothing wrong with that. And, you know, but he had just moved on to another role in the company. But they held me responsible for that, I guess. So.
Dang, that's rough. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So I got to ask this question from one of our listeners. He wants to know if you met Chris Metzen at Blizzard.
You know, I think I did. That sounds very familiar. I hope the listener realizes that it's been 14 years or whatever, you know, 15 years, whatever it is since I went down to that meeting. Was he an art director?
He's the art guy. He did a lot of the original Blizzard artwork for Warcraft and Starcraft.
Oh man, I'm taking serious credit for coming up with that, you know, with my aging brain. Yeah, I met him, and not only did I meet him, I remember him, but I remember his office, which blew my mind. I got a tour of their offices and everything. I mentioned earlier that they had this incredible campus. And I remember meeting him. He had a ponytail. And was you know, that hung down in front, you know, it came around. It was a big ponytail. I remember that. And it kind of like had a question mark at the end, curled up. I remember him as a good looking dude. And then he just had all of these fabulous models and miniatures and art and, you know, kind of like game Trotskys, if there is such a thing, all over his office. It was just like another universe in there. And he was very welcoming, very kind, and fun to talk to. So, yes.
Dang, that's super cool. That's a great answer. Let me see. So I have a few kind of short questions for you, rapid fire as we wrap up. So on this one's personal for me. In Heaven's Devils, the characters say feckin' and flickin' instead of harsher expletives. Was that your choice or Blizzard's choice, and why is that?
I have no idea. I don't remember. Trying to think of her name off the top of my head. But anyway, I had an editor from the publisher. I think it was Simon Schuster, if I'm not mistaken. And she was running interference on a lot of this stuff between the Blizzard people and me. So she could have been somewhere in that whole thing too. I don't know. But, you know, I would get very, very detailed feedback. I would submit it a chapter at a time. That's what they wanted. And they wanted to approve each chapter, you know, and approve it before I moved on to another chapter. Because if they were not happy with something in a chapter, they didn't want to build on, you know, on what they would regard as a mistake and then create more mistakes down the line. So it was chapter by chapter approvals. And I would get very detailed feedback, and that could have easily been one of those things, you know, that I got on a detailed list of feedback. And on something like that, you know, when you're when you're writing for an IP, when you're doing work for hire, you need to really take yourself out of it a little bit. You need to understand that this is their world. This is their universe. They created it. You did not. They own it. You do not. You are a hired hand, and you're there to do a certain job for them, just like you would in any company or whatever. And you need to take orders. This is not, you know, and you need, if you want to do more of that kind of work and you want to be successful at it without being obsequious or being or withholding good ideas, you should never do that. You should always offer up your good ideas. But nor should you, you know, say, no, I'm not doing that. No, you're wrong. No, they're not wrong. This is their property. By definition, they're right. there wouldn't be any property if they hadn't done a lot of things right. And Blizzard was no exception to that. You know, they knew what they wanted, and I was there to try and give it to them.
Yeah. Well, dang, honestly, that sounds really hard as an author, but the novel turned out great. So,
well, good. I'm glad yeah. you like it. I remember the characters well, and I remember enjoying the opportunity to do the two guys, the two bros, you know. Mm-hmm. I just thought they were great, just great characters, the way they offset each other and so on. So I really liked that whole theme.
So I know that you like first person shooters. Did you happen to play StarCraft? I mean, I know it's a very different genre, but
I'm not a StarCraft guy. No, not really. But you're right. I love first person shooters. You know, so
what are some of your favorites?
Well, okay, so certainly all of the Halo novels, right? Mm-hmm. Far Cry. I love the Far Cry shooters. Far Cry 2 is my favorite of all, and really? I know that's going to sound really retro since Far Cry 6 exists, and I've played it. But Far Cry 2, just to me, I just wish they would remake it with today's graphics and today's color and, you know, and just clean up some of the, you know, kind of weird. There were some weird things in there. But the freedom of it, you know, the freedom that they gave you, if there's any geeks in your audience who are into this kind of stuff, I'll just say for a moment. The balance on the weapons, the weapons that were available, the way they could be used, particularly the sniper rifles, best sniper rifle loadout in every game I've ever played in Far Cry 2, better than all the rest of the Far Cry games in my estimation, where snipery is just kind of kissed off, I think, where you can tell I like that sneaking around stealth stuff. So definitely like those. Let's see. Those are the ones that come to mind off the top. I know there's more. Crysis. I like the Crysis games. Those are good. I do some of the military games, you know, some of the, you know, but I'm more into the science fiction than I am the current stuff.
Yeah. Dang, that's cool. Why don't you pitch one of your novels to our listeners?
Pitch one of my novels to a listener?
To our listeners. So
pitch it in what sense? One I haven't written or one that I have?
Oh, sorry. One that you have written. So you just have an extensive backlog, and if someone wanted to start reading your work, where would you tell them to go first?
All right. Well, since you brought up the World War III self-published series, I would pitch to them Red Ice. So that's the concept is that just about the entire world is at war. Let me back up a minute. By the end of the book, the whole world is at war. But at the beginning of the book, the World War III starts. And, you know, it focuses in on a person whose job it is in the military to call in airstrikes and so on certain targets. And he does something wrong. He makes a mistake. It's sort of his fault, sort of not.
Yeah.
But as a result, he gets a bad reputation and he's shipped off to Alaska. And sort of the thing that makes this book different, and it gives it a little bit of a little feel of science fiction, but not really, because this, what I'm about to describe, actually is physically possible, though it's never been done. But as the war starts, and China starts the war, but Russia joins in on China's behalf or with them as an ally, they start to build a bridge across the Bering Strait. And and this is a floating bridge, and it's just designed to carry traffic one way, and that's towards the United States from Russia. And it just only has to last one season, you know, because there's ice and all of that. But it only has to last for a certain period of time to get enough troops into Alaska where they can actually fight America on its own territory. So there's the pitch.
That's cool.
That's the basic idea. The secondary character is a female fighter pilot that he eventually meets, and, you know, they get along okay. How's that?
Yeah, that's great.
And there's an evil Russian fighter pilot that she has to fight in the sky. And, you know, there's lots of other things. There's, you know, the Coast Guard usually doesn't get any kind of credit in war novels, but the Coast Guard gets credit in this one. And then, you know, it sets the, it sets it up for all the rest of the books. I think there's eight of them now. And, you know, so the war progresses and the characters change as explained earlier. And it goes from theater to theater.
Dang, that sounds fascinating. I love it.
Good. It was fun to research and show it. And it's been considered. The bridge has been considered. But when you think about, put it in the context of a war and so on, and the Russians are trying to build it and we're trying to stop them, it makes for a pretty good story.
Yeah, excellent.
And once again, the Russians are the bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, just like it turns out they really are. Anyway, I mean, it seems more and more real every day.
Dang, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Let me ask you just a couple more quick questions.
Sure.
Who beta reads your books?
My wife, the editor. But
yeah, excellent.
But she does not read science fiction or military stuff on her own. Oh. She edits and proofs my books. Excuse me, getting hoarse. And she, but she will read them, and if she sees a discontinuity or something like that, she'll call it out. But she's not a fan, you know. She's just like, and she doesn't think I'm really much of a big deal at all. And she just, you know, and that's healthy.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
What does work-life balance look like in your life?
I work about 4 or 5 hours a day, 7 days a week, holidays included. I write 2 novels a year. And I do very little else. I don't play golf. I don't hunt. I don't fish. I'm getting a little too old for it now, but for a long time, I was a serious canoeist, expedition canoeing, you know, the kind of thing like a buddy and I did 230 miles on the Big Salmon River up in the Yukon 1 year, around the Bowron circuit up in Canada, Nation Lakes in Canada, you know, like that. I mean, the kind of thing where, you know, it's wilderness canoeing. That was my thing as far as the sport was concerned. But sadly, I'm a little past it now.
Dang, well, that sounds fun. I assume you're working on your next World War III novel right now. Is that your current project?
I just published Red Dog here 2 months ago, so that's out there. And I plan to write more novels. The next one will be called Red Line, and it'll take the whole scenario to Korea, which I've been waiting to do. I've put it off a little bit because Korea is going to be really, really hard. It's going to be a hard book to write. It's going to require a lot of research. But I think I'm up for it. But to answer your question right now, before I start that book about Korea. I'm writing a sequel to the Legion of the Damned series called From the Ashes. And it jumps 60 years forward from the Andromeda books. The lady in the background right here is Andromeda McKee. And she's in the prequel. Well, wait a minute. I've got that wrong. So she's in the prequel one, the first three books. Then comes the 8, 9 books in the middle. And then this is going to be the sequel that goes on the end, the last Legion book. Whereas and that's what my my agent calls it, the last Legion book. He thinks that has a ring to it. And I think it probably will be the last Legion book.
Huh. Dang, that's awesome. What book are you going to read tonight?
You know, that's a that's an unfortunate side effect of doing what I do. I don't get to read much. In fact, my idea of an exciting vacation is to like go somewhere and read books one after another. Mm-hmm. So I won't be reading a book tonight because after I've written, you know, and edited and done all kinds of writing stuff all day, I usually just don't feel like reading.
Yeah. Yep.
Sad story.
I can understand that. That is a sad story. who is an author you look up to?
Well, this is going to be, people expect me to answer within that question within the framework of science fiction and so on, and I will. I'll say the greats were a big part of my childhood. Heinlein, Asimov, you know, Clark, all of the greats there. Mm-hmm. But I've also been influenced by guys who just write war fiction, people that your listeners probably have not heard of, but like Douglas Riemann, who wrote World War II fiction, for example. Mm. The structure of his novels, I mean, it's about World War II, and it's about, you know, World War II Navy, British Navy battles and so on. But the structure of it, you know, is the same structure as, say, the structure of C.S. Forrester's Hornblower books or, you know, or Star Trek books or Star Wars books. You know, the nature of the hero, the nature of the challenge, the process, which I love those kind of stories. That would be an example of somebody who's maybe, you know, a stranger to some of your audience anyway.
Dang, that's great. What is the one book that has had the greatest impact on your life?
Greatest impact on my life. that's really a difficult question. Frankl's book. The meaning of...
Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning. Thank you.
Hmm. Wow, cool.
Yeah, it's not science fiction. It's not war. But it's a very important book about our ability to find meaning even in terrible suffering. I think Stoicism is kind of a thing right now in some quarters and in some ways it touches on that. But I would say that in terms of what I think is the most significant book I've read, that might be it. When it comes to literary books, I'm a big Kafka fan, you know, I mean imagery and everything of a Kafka book, you know, pigs under the porch and, people who've read Kafka will know what I'm talking about. I love Kafka. So there's that. Clemens, you know, Mark Twain, ate those books up as a kid. And, you know, the process there, unfortunately, people have trouble these days with the racist, and it is racist, you know, content. But yet, on the other hand, from a literary perspective, the characters and everything are so rich and so giving that, you know, that it's really important. And I guess it's important, I think, for people, you know, your podcast is called Start Writing. You know, well, when you start writing, you need to have read a lot to start writing. And you need to, I believe you need to have read a lot of different things and bring that to what you do. And you will, whether you intend to bring it or not. It'll be there somewhere buried in everything that you do, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to ask you this question, but maybe you just barely answered it. I was just going to let you have the parting words, and that can be an ask of our audience, or it can be a tip, or maybe there's a question that I should have asked but didn't. But do you have any parting words that you'd like to share?
Well, I didn't expect the question, but I do have an answer, and that is, you know, there is right now in certain parts of the United States and within certain minds a desire to, you know, to ban books. Don't do that. Fight it. Your freedom, your future depends on it. The freedom of speech is so, so important to what we're doing every day and to how we live and to who we are. You know, vote for people who will never ban books. Give money to people who want to, who support freedom of speech. I guess that's it. Just remember what an important part of our life in America that is, and protect it.
Dang, that's super cool. I love that. Bill, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. If someone wants to keep up with you, where do they go? You mentioned your email list. How can someone sign up for that?
Absolutely. You can reach me, actually the way you did, through my website, which is williamcdeets.com. And my email there is william@williamcdeets.com. I will answer every single email that comes in. I always do. You can also reach me on Facebook. I'm there, William C. Dietz. You can search and find me very easily. And I check it once a day. And so you can get to me that way too. And those are the two best routes.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a huge pleasure for me. I loved reading your works. And yeah, this is an awesome conversation. I think it'll be really helpful for our listeners too.
Well, thank you, Jay. You're an officer and a scholar. I'm impressed by your knowledge of everything and all the research you did, for this this opportunity. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Okay, and to our listeners, it's time to start writing.
Tyranny rules the galaxy. Tiberos has crushed every hint of rebellion. Like the grip of his cybernetic hand, he maintains a relentless hold on the populace. The power he hates most is the psionic magic of the song. A force so strong it flows out as light from the eyes. People with such powers are called radiances, and Tiberos's witch hunters kidnap any that surface. As the radiances slowly vanish, so does the galaxy's hope. Till Kaulet White Sun, one of the last radiances, gives a risky speech denouncing Tiberos and the extermination of her kind. The message spreads across the galaxy like the light of a supernova. She becomes revered as the uncrowned queen, the one with the power to finally unite the people. And then doom falls in the form of the crushing hand of Tiberos. He captures Kaulet, sentencing her to the darkest dungeons and imminent death. All hope is lost. Until a lone pilot appears. A pilot who wants nothing to do with Colette or her rebellion, yet who may in fact be the galaxy's last hope. A pilot whose ship, the Sanctum, was created by an ancient alien race. A pilot who stole that ship from Tiberos himself. A renegade pilot named Starchild.
Get the Starchild paperback, ebook, or audiobook at starchild.jwashburn.com.